Thanks, Jonathan, and welcome to the program. On the show today, meet the Greek entrepreneurs bucking the trend and making money online. And our Moscow correspondent Norman Hermont catches up with the husband of one of Russia's Pussy Rioters. Those stories coming up shortly, but first, without doubt, the United States has some of the world's finest and largest national parks, and it has a big, reasonably well-funded federal agency to run them as well. In fact, the US was the first country in the world to dedicate a stretch of wilderness as a national park back in 1872, when Congress designated the area known as Yellowstone. Since then, millions of people have visited Yellowstone. Among them most recently was our North America correspondent Michael Brissenden. And as he reports, touring an American national park is a uniquely American experience.
A few years ago, I shot a story for ABC TV's Foreign Correspondent on the impact of the reintroduction of the wolf to the Northern Rockies. Until the first pack of wolves was released in Yellowstone National Park in 1995, there hadn't been a wolf seen south of the Canadian border for more than 70 years. But as it unfolded, our story became more than just a story about the wolf. We actually never saw a wolf in the wild. But the wolf became a metaphor for a much wider discussion that continues to rage through the American experience. It's a story of development versus wilderness, agriculture versus nature, the federal powers versus states' rights, and East Coast liberal views of environmental protection versus the views and concerns of many of the people who actually live in or near the wild places in the US. The fact that the debate continues is testament in itself to the commitment many of the country's political leaders have had over the decades to preserving and protecting some of the truly diverse and spectacular American countryside. And it is truly spectacular countryside, so spectacular that almost the moment I walked back in the door after shooting for 2 weeks on the road, I promised my own family that we'd get back there before this posting was through. 2 years later, I made good on that promise. But a trip to an American national park is a singularly American experience, and it's not just the bears, the elk, and the wolves that define it. For a start, Yellowstone itself is also a sort of museum, a celebration of the early days of American environmentalism, and of the era when getting away from it all really took some planning. The posters, the advertising, and the park signs are cast in a stylized early 20th century font and palette, and the grand hotels like the Old Faithful and Mammoth revel in their Bakelite-era authenticity. But that's where the 1920s end. These days, a trip to an American park like Yellowstone is a truly 21st century experience. The main goal for most is to complete a list of animal sightings. Wolves and bears are at the top of everyone's list, followed by coyotes, moose, elk, bison and beavers, all the way down to badgers, squirrels and the lesser rodents. That's all well and good, of course. It's what you'd expect from a trip to the wilderness. However, the way the overwhelming majority of park visitors bag their game is not by trekking into the wild, it's from inside the comfortably air-conditioned SUV. In fact, the most popular way to find animals in Yellowstone is to look for the traffic jam. Take a drive. The roads are clogged with others just like you looking for bears. And it seems that's the way people like it. But being unfamiliar with this form of getting back to nature, we obviously also wanted to walk. And while there are a few guided walks, many of them are catered towards a level of fitness enjoyed by those normally unfamiliar with the workings of their own feet. Most last barely an hour, cover little more than a kilometre of terrain, and include frequent stops. We used to have 3 and 4 hour walks, one ranger told us, but people just stopped taking them. For all that, it is possible to get off the main road and hike into the backcountry. The thing is, there's almost no one there. Truly spectacular. This is Michael Brissenden reporting for Correspondents Report.
Greece's economic woes have certainly resulted in some disturbing headlines. Just this week, it was suggested that Greece could sell or lease some of the country's islands to help revive a state asset sales plan, central to it receiving international funds. The big picture is ugly, but there are some entrepreneurs in Greece who have found salvation online. The World Today's Eleanor Hall has recently returned from Greece, and she sent us this report.
We've got an order with 3 envoys.
We're performing very well, unexpectedly well.
As he packs up his latest order of olive oils to ship overseas, Fotis Antonopoulos is well aware that he is in a privileged position in a country that's on the brink of bankruptcy. Like many young Greeks, he's highly educated. But unlike most of his peers, he has a well-paid job in an IT company. And now he's also started an online business selling olive products.
We have some countries that we would never expect to see an order coming from Malawi or Mongolia. We've sold almost in every continent in this planet. Hopefully we'll start selling to Mars as well.
Greece is the third biggest olive oil producer in the world, so giving olive farmers an online avenue to the international market could be seen as a smart business move. But when he set up oliveshop.com as the economic crisis in his country escalated, this internet entrepreneur says he wasn't driven so much by the prospect of making money as by the desire to showcase an idea that might inspire other young Greeks to stay in their country.
The main idea was to show people that technology can act as the means to getting out of the crisis, to use that as an example to young people to assist in a small way our country. When you have a country that's losing all the workforce that could produce solutions to the problem, then things are not good.
On this Athens street, summer holiday exuberance is providing some reprieve from the recent anti-austerity rioting. But it's hard to escape the signs of the crisis.
Yeah, Hermus Street used to be on the top 10 of the most expensive commercial streets globally. Within the last 2 years with the crisis, almost 2 out of 3 stores have closed down.
And it's hard to overstate the impact of the crisis on the country's young people. The government is slashing its spending and closing off what used to be the main avenue for professional employment for young Greeks, the public service. The economy is forecast not just to stagnate, but to contract by almost 7% this year. And the unemployment rate among Greeks aged between 18 and 24 is a staggering 52%.
I don't know if I can find words. Almost desperate, I have to say. We don't know what are we going to do after we finish our studies.
I don't want to start a family with those problems.
So you're putting that off now?
Yes.
Even though you have a job?
Yes. I don't know what will happen next year. I don't know what will happen in 6 months.
Yes, we have suicides, many suicides. Yes, people are not going through the best times.
How many people do you know who are wanting to get out of Greece?
Almost anyone, even me at some point. But despite all this difficult situation, we can achieve much better things. All we have to do is focus.
And Fotis Antonopoulos is not alone in seeing the relatively low-cost option of online innovation as a way out of the economic crisis.
Digital technologies and the internet are very much what I would describe in the 21st century, what, for instance, electricity was in the 19th century. It really transforms the entire economy.
Anne Mettler is the executive director and co-founder of the Lisbon Council, a knowledge economy think tank based in Brussels. While some may question the timing of this transformation, she says any solution to the Europe-wide economic crisis which doesn't embrace the digital economy is doomed to fail. And she's adamant that Greece cannot wait until it's back in the black.
No, because governments need to be able to do more than one thing. So yes, they need to deal with the crisis, undoubtedly. But the real thing they need to do is to try to understand where does the future value of the European economy come from. And if we fall behind in this area, in the digital economy, we are dead for all practical purposes. And a place like Greece particularly needs to look at this. Much of the Greek economy depends on tourism. If you take tourism online, you could export to countries that perhaps aren't as hard hit, reach customers that, you know, perhaps you otherwise wouldn't reach. And Greece has a very strategic position between the Middle East and Europe, so it has markets that are growing. You know, there is huge potential here, but in my opinion, the Greek policymakers pay no attention to this.
Interestingly, Greece's special secretary of digital planning agrees with this bleak assessment of the policymakers in his country. But we'll come to him in a moment. Certainly, olive shop entrepreneur Fotis Antonopoulos found the process of starting up an internet business in Greece a lot harder than he'd anticipated.
Yes, unfortunately, yes. The bureaucratic adventure we had to go through was a bit frustrating. It's very difficult. It's very difficult to open such kind of businesses in Greece because it's very difficult for the public services and the government to understand what technology can offer.
He also had to convince the olive farmers that the internet had something to offer them. How did the farmers react when you went to them with this idea of selling online?
It depends on the age. The old farmers that couldn't understand technology at all, they didn't care at all. But we could see that young growers or children of those farmers, they liked very much the idea. It was an online channel that would sell the products globally. So they were very, very supportive of the whole idea.
Katerina!
The products for the online olive shop now come from all over Greece, including from Crete, the island closest to Greece's potential market in the Middle East. Here, the tourism season is now in full swing, and a food and wine festival is underway to promote the products of the island, which is famous for the longevity of its residents. One of the Crete festival organisers is local businesswoman Katerina Zekalou.
And with our great tradition, gastronomical and enologic tradition that we've got, our aim is to bring the Cretan diet out of our borders, abroad.
This honey, Timian honey, this is traditional in Crete. Taste, produced from my family. This is it in Crete.
Oh, that is beautiful honey.
Yes, very beautiful.
My name is Nikos Voyatzidakis. I'm coming from a small village from Rethymno, and we have a small family business making cheese. You can try. This is the most famous Cretan cheese, this Graviera from Creta.
Mm, thank you. So tell me, how is business?
It's difficult in Greece. It's difficult. We have to pay everything in cash. We had the credit about 3-4 months. Now we don't have it. Electricity is expensive. Petrol is expensive. Everything is expensive. We'll see. But our products are pure and very good, and I think they finally going to find their way to the markets.
So maybe digital, maybe going online might be a way sometime?
I don't understand exactly what is digital economy, but in our section it's difficult, because I think it's very difficult.
But while the farmers might take some convincing, for Fotis Antonopoulos, it was the bureaucratic process involved in setting up a business in Greece that almost defeated him and his online olive shop concept. So tell us about the most frustrating barriers that you had to go through, the hoops you had to jump through to get your shop online.
We've seen some tremendous stories, honestly. One was that at the health inspection office, they demanded from us to have x-rays and stool samples, which is crazy in a way. When you start selling olive oil, I could never understand the reason why I should have given stool samples, and my apologies to the audience on this one. At some point, we were so much frustrated that we couldn't do anything, so we started seeing this as a whole joke. But I have to say that we were very lucky to have the job, so it wasn't a problem for us to go through all this delay.
So do you think that you would have been able to set up this business if you didn't also have a very high-paying alternative job?
No. If I want to be totally honest with you, when we reached the second month of all this procedure, we wanted to stop it and go to another country, start olive shop from there. We thought of the UK, which you can open a business in less than a day.
You say that it would take less than a day in the UK. How long did it take in Greece for you?
9 months.
9 months?
Yeah. 6.5 months that we have to go through all the public services and around 2 months to go through with the banks.
9 months before when?
When I put this to Antonis Markopoulos, Greece's Digital Planning Special Secretary, he at first refused to believe it.
This is not my view, 9 months.
He said he'd pushed through a one-stop shop for entrepreneurs in Greece to capitalise on Greece's strength in IT engineering and its highly educated population, where 1 in 10 Greeks have master's degrees or PhDs.
So there's a huge opportunity, and it's a sector that, you know, it's not a capital-driven sector. You just need good engineers, that we have a great human capital. It's one of the things that I believe that it's the only asset right now for Greece, the human capital. And we need to motivate these people to start up companies in the technological sector.
But he then became remarkably frank about his frustrations in trying to modernise a corrupt and inefficient Greek public sector and improve the environment for Greek entrepreneurs.
You said a moment ago that it was easy to make these changes. Nobody is going to protest in the streets because you make these changes. So why hasn't the government made these changes before?
A difficult question. My feeling is the ministers. My experience says that these kind of people, there's a lack of knowledge what is happening outside their offices. And this is a huge problem about the majority of politicians. They don't have the real picture of the society and of the businesses.
Antonis Markopoulos doesn't fit the mould of Greece's career political players. He was lured from the largest IT company in the Greek private sector by the then Prime Minister, George Papandreou, who asked him to become the nation's new Special Secretary of Digital Planning nearly 3 years ago. He found the public service and government remarkably ignorant about technology.
I'm coming from the private sector, so I'm not a pure politician, let's say. I'm trying to convince the Ministry of Finance to move on.
And how are you going with that?
I'm not going nowhere. I couldn't even find people with some ears open. Frankly speaking, I don't know why. The previous government didn't have the imagination to set up some new things and to attract the growth, to attract new businesses, to attract investments in Greece. So there are proposals on the table. I hope now the new government will take this proposal and to bring them into reality.
When I put that hope to Fotis Antonopoulos, he wasn't exactly brimming with confidence about the new government.
I wish I could be very optimistic. My job position says that technology can assist on this one, but I hold a small basket. That's a proverb, a Greek proverb that says that don't believe anything you hear. Especially in this country, you have to be very skeptical when it comes to applying policies that are technology related. Unfortunately, we've reached 2012 and in a way we haven't used technology as we should have used it ages before.
So now it's up to the new Greek government to take decisions that will have huge implications for the future of Greece and its increasingly desperate young people. The digital secretary says it must show that it's capable of real reform, and soon.
If Greece and the Greek government in the next, not a year, not even a year, but in the next few months, don't manage to prove that it's capable to reform and to manage this difficult situation, I think the scenario of a Greek exit out of the Eurozone might be a reality. I hope not. I'm a person that I feel a European citizen. I travel in Europe. I belong to Europe. And we don't want to see Greece out of Europe. But it's not in Europe's hand. It's in our hand to achieve that.
Anne Mettler says this is a critical moment for the whole of Europe.
Yes, absolutely. I would say that this is a make-or-break situation. Either the Europeans now get it together, not only on the immediate crisis and sort of stabilizing the situation, but really kick-starting growth and jobs, which will ultimately get us out of the crisis.
Even though his online olive shop is now going from strength to strength, Fotis Antonopoulos is no longer as certain as he was that his experience in setting it up will inspire others to follow his example. But he's maintaining his optimism and his sense of humour.
A lot of people in Australia say, oh, Greece will not survive in the Eurozone. It will go back to the drachma. What do you think should happen?
Well, that's a very difficult question to answer. People want to find jobs, people want to find their smiles back, people want to find something to believe on to continue with their lives. So if I had to pick through this dilemma, which is a very difficult one, I would have gone for the staying in the Eurozone and keeping the euro, if the Europeans still want us.
Eleanor Hall with that report. More than a week after their sentence, there are still few firm answers as to where the jailed members of the Russian punk group Pussy Riot will be serving their sentences. Three women in the group were given two-year jail terms for an anti-Putin performance in a Russian Orthodox cathedral. The sentence sparked outrage. But in an interview with Moscow correspondent Norman Hermont, the husband of one of the convicted band members says the verdict will only strengthen Russia's opposition.
On the day three members of Pussy Riot were sentenced, the band showed its defiance by releasing its new single, Putin Lights Up the Fires. One of the lines in the chorus says, 7 years isn't enough. Another goes, Putin is going to say goodbye like a sheep. When I interviewed the husband of Nadia Tolokonnikova, one of the jailed band members, this week, he'd just been given court approval to see his wife for the first time since she was sentenced. Pietr Verzilov is a longtime political and social activist and an early member of the famed Voyna Art Collective. The trial of Pussy Riot, he says, has been a gift to the opposition from the Kremlin.
Why do you think they've let it get this far? It seems like it just got out of hand.
Well, because just given Putin's psychology, he wasn't up to forgiving these girls for doing this bright, creative and loud protest that they've done. So he was set out to punish them. And that's basically what he did. He showed to Russia and to the whole world that people who brightly, effectively and loudly speak critically of the government, they will not be tolerated in this country. They will be crushed and sent to prison.
What would you say to people who say that they are Russian Orthodox believers and they were really upset by what they saw on the internet or what they heard happened in the church?
Well, I think this is a very cynical and quite an untrue position, because if you call yourself a Christian believer, then you have to stand up for Christian values, which mean forgiveness, love, tolerance, and, well, everything else Christianity has stood for in the last 2,000 years. So you can't really say that you're a Christian believer and you were offended by what happened in the church. You can, on the other hand, say that I'm not really a Christian believer, but I do stand out for traditional values, for rituals, for other very important practices which have existed in this in these country in the medieval ages. And this is more important to me than Christianity. And in this case, you can say that you're insulted, but just don't say that you're Christian in that case.
What do you think when you hear poll results that indicate large numbers of Russians think that these women do deserve some sort of jail sentence?
A significant number of Russia's population really gets all its news, impressions and emotions from three main federal television channels which exist in Russia. And this is precisely the portion of the population which speaks very critical on Pussy Riot because these three main television channels, they've ran a series of programs which portray Pussy Riot as this horrible foreign commanded band with the aims of which has the aims of destroying Russian traditional values, bringing the revolution to this country and tearing the country apart. And a lot of people really believe these shows and what is said about Pussy Riot on television.
What do you think these jail terms are going to do for the protest movement? Do you think they're going to energize the protest movement?
I think they will energize the protest movement because people are now becoming more radicalized and more new people are joining the protest which haven't been there before, because what they see, these brutalities, they see that not oligarchs, not political, not professional politicians, not people who have participated in even in mass protests and were arrested at these protests. No, just people who choose a very creative and loud way of protesting, even they get arrested. So people will definitely be joining in.
This is August. The summer is coming to an end. Many people are speculating that it could be a very turbulent fall in terms of protests when people come back and turn their minds to what's happening in this country. What do you think is in store?
Well, it definitely will be. The first protest is set for September 15th, and we just have to see how many people show up. It might be 50,000, might be 100,000, might be 200,000. But it's obvious that Putin has done everything that he could, including arrest of people that took part in the previous May 6th protest, the big jail sentences for members of Pussy Riot, and tightening of election laws. So he did everything that he could to attract more people to the streets. We'll just see how many more.
Since his return as president, Vladimir Putin has already shown he has few qualms in squeezing out political dissent in Russia. Come this fall, opposition activists like Pyotr Vezilov and Pussy Riot are determined to make him go even further. This is Norman Hermont in Moscow for Correspondence Report.
That's all from Correspondence Report this week. I'm Elizabeth Jackson. Join me again at the same time next week for more thoughts and stories from the ABC's foreign correspondents. Now it's back to Jonathan Green and Sunday Extra.